3. The illusion of monopoly price. So far, we have established that there is nothing wrong with a monopoly price, either when instituted by one firm or by a cartel, that, in fact, whatever price the free market, unhampered by violence or the threat of violence, establishes, will be the best price. We have also shown the impossibility of separating monopolizing from efficiency considerations in cartel actions, or of separating technology from profitability in general, and we have seen the great instability of the cartel form. In this section, we investigate a further problem. Granted that there is nothing wrong with monopoly prices, how tenable is the very concept of monopoly price on the free market? Can it be distinguished at all from competitive price, its supposed polar opposite? To answer this question, we must explore what the theory of monopoly price is all about. A. Definitions of monopoly. Before investigating the theory of monopoly price, we must begin by defining monopoly. Despite the fact that monopoly problems occupy an enormous quantity of economic writings, little or no clarity of definition exists. The same confusion exists in the laws concerning monopoly. Despite constitutional warnings against vagueness, the Sherman Antitrust Act outlaws monopolizing actions without once defining the concept. To this day, there has been no clear legislative decision concerning what constitutes illegal monopolistic action. There is, in fact, enormous vagueness and confusion on the subject. Very few economists have formulated a coherent, meaningful definition of monopoly. A common example of a confused definition is monopoly exists when a firm has control over its price. This definition is a mixture of confusion and absurdity. In the first place, on the free market, there is no such thing as control over the price in an exchange. In any exchange, the price of the sale is voluntarily agreed upon by both parties. No control is exercised by either party. The only control is each person's control over his own actions, stemming from his self-sovereignty, and consequently, his control will be over his own decision to enter or not to enter into an exchange at any hypothetical price. There is no direct control over price because price is a mutual phenomenon. On the other hand, each person has absolute control over his own action, and therefore over the price which he will attempt to charge for any particular good. Any man can set any price that he wants for any quantity of a good that he sells. The question is whether he can find any buyers at that price. Similarly, of course, any buyer can set any price at which he will purchase a certain good. The question is whether he can find a seller at that price. It is this process, indeed, of mutual bids and offers that yields the daily prices on the market. There is an all too common assumption, however, that if we compare, say, Henry Ford and a small wheat farmer, the two differ enormously in their respective powers of control. It is believed that the wheat farmer finds his price given to him by the market, while Ford can administer or set his own price. The wheat farmer is allegedly subject to the impersonal forces of the market, and ultimately to the consumer, while Ford is, to a greater or lesser extent, the master of his own fate, if not indeed the ruler of the consumers. Further, it is believed that Ford's monopoly power stems from his being large in relation to the automobile market, while the farmer is a pure competitor because he is small compared to the total supply of wheat. Usually, Ford is not considered an absolute monopolist, but someone with a vague degree of monopoly power. In the first place, it is completely false to say that the farmer and Ford differ in their control over price. Both have exactly the same degree of control and of non-control. That is, both have absolute control over the quantity they produce and the price which they attempt to get, and absolute non-control over the price and quantity transaction that finally takes place. We are, of course, not considering here particular uncertainties of agriculture resulting from climate, etc. The farmer is free to ask any price he wants, just as Ford is, and is free to look for a buyer at such a price. He is not in the least compelled to sell his produce to the organized markets if he can do better elsewhere. Every producer of every product is free in a free market society to produce as much as he wants of whatever he possesses or can purchase, and to try to sell it at whatever price he can get to anyone he can find. Naturally, every seller, as we have repeatedly stated, will attempt to sell his produce for the highest possible price. Similarly, every buyer will attempt to purchase goods at the lowest possible price. It is precisely the voluntary interaction of these buyers and sellers that establishes the entire supply and demand structure for consumers' and producers' goods. To accuse Ford or a waterworks or any other producer of charging whatever the traffic will bear, and to take this as a sign of monopoly, is pure nonsense, for this is precisely the action of everyone in the economy, the small wheat farmer, the laborer, the landowner, etc. Charging whatever the traffic will bear is simply a rather emotive synonym for charging as high a price as can be freely obtained. Who officially sets the price in any exchange is a completely trivial and irrelevant technological question, a matter of institutional convenience rather than economic analysis. The fact that Macy's posts its prices each day does not mean that Macy's has some sort of mysterious control of its price over the consumer. Similarly, that large-scale industrial buyers of raw materials often post their bid prices does not mean that they exercise some sort of extra control over the price obtained by the growers. Rather than acting as a means of control, in fact, posting simply furnishes needed information to all would-be buyers and/or sellers. The process of price determination through the interaction of value scales occurs in precisely the same way, regardless of the concrete details and institutional conditions of market arrangements. Each individual producer, then, is sovereign over his own actions. He is free to buy, produce, and sell whatever he likes, and to whoever will purchase. The farmer is not compelled to sell to any particular market or to any particular company, any more than Ford is compelled to sell to John Brown if he does not wish to do so, say because he can get a higher price elsewhere. But as we have seen, insofar as a producer wishes to maximize his monetary return, he does submit himself to the control of consumers, and he sets his output accordingly. This is true of the farmer, of Ford, or of anyone else in the entire economy, landowner, laborer, service producer, product owner, etc. Ford, then, has no more control over the consumer than the farmer has. One common objection is that Ford is able to acquire monopoly power or monopolistic power because his product has a recognized brand name or trademark, which the wheat farmer has not. This, however, is surely a case of putting the cart before the horse. The brand name and the wide knowledge of the brand come from consumers' desire for the product attached to that particular brand, and are therefore a result of consumer demand, rather than a pre-existing means for some sort of monopolistic power over the consumers. In fact, farmer Hiram Jones is perfectly free to stamp the brand name Hiram Jones Wheat on his product and attempt to sell it on the market. The fact that he has not done so signifies that it would not be a profitable step in the concrete market condition of his product. The chief point is that in some cases, consumers and lower-order entrepreneurs consider each individual brand name as representing a unique product, while in other cases, purchasers consider the output of one firm, one product owner or set of product owners operating jointly, as identical in use value with products of other firms. Which situation will occur is entirely dependent on the buyer's valuations in each concrete case. Later in this chapter, we shall analyze in greater detail the tangled web of fallacies involved in the various theories of monopolistic competition. At this point, we are attempting to arrive at a definition of monopoly per se. To proceed, there are three possible coherent definitions of monopoly. One is derived from its linguistic roots, monos, only, and polene, to sell, that is, the only seller of any given good. Definition 1. This is certainly a legitimate definition, but it is an extraordinarily broad one. It means that whenever there is any differentiation at all among individual products, the individual producer and seller is a monopolist. John Jones, lawyer, is a monopolist over the legal services of John Jones. Tom Williams, doctor, is a monopolist over his own unique medical services, etc. The owner of the Empire State Building is a monopolist over the rental services in his building. This definition, therefore, labels all consumer distinctions between individual products as establishing monopolies. It must be remembered that only consumers can decide whether two commodities offered on the market are one good or two different goods. This issue cannot be settled by a physical inspection of the product. The elemental physical nature of the good may be only one of its properties. In most cases, a brand name, the goodwill of a particular company, or a more pleasant atmosphere in the store will differentiate the product from its rivals in the view of many of its customers. The products then become different goods for the consumers. No one can ever be certain in advance, least of all the economist, whether a commodity sold by A will be treated on the market as homogeneous with the same basic physical good sold by B. Economists have often charged, for example, that consumers who will pay a higher price for the same good at a store with a more pleasant atmosphere are acting irrationally. Actually, they are by no means doing so, since consumers are buying not just a physical can of beans, but a can of beans sold in a certain store by certain clerks, and these factors may or may not make a difference to them. Businessmen are far less motivated by such non-physical considerations, although goodwill affects their purchases too. Not because they are more rational than consumers, but because they are not concerned, as consumers are, with their own value scales in deciding their purchases. As we have seen above, businessmen are generally motivated purely by the expected revenue that goods will bring on the market. Professor Lawrence Abbott, in one of the outstanding theoretical works of recent years, demonstrates also that as civilization and the economy advance, products will become more and more differentiated and less homogeneous. For one thing, greater differentiation occurs at the consumer than at the producer level, and the expanding economy takes over an increasing proportion of goods once made by the consumer himself, and therefore supplies more finished goods than raw materials to the consumer than formerly. Bread rather than flour, sweaters rather than wool yarn, etc. Thus, there is greater opportunity for differentiation. Furthermore, to the familiar charge that business advertising tends to create differentiation in the consumer's mind that is not really there, Abbott replies incisively that the reverse is more likely to be true, and that advancing civilization increases the consumer's perception and discrimination of differences of which he was previously ignorant. Writes Abbott, "As man becomes more civilized, he develops greater powers of perception with regard to quality differences. Subjective homogeneity may exist even when objective homogeneity does not, due to the inability or unwillingness of buyers to perceive differences between almost identical products and discriminate between them. As a society matures and education improves, people learn to develop more acute powers of discrimination. Their wants become more detailed. They begin to develop a preference, say, not simply for white wine, but for 1948 Chablis. People generally tend to underestimate the significance of apparently trivial differences in fields in which they are not expert. An unmusical person may be unwilling to concede that there is any difference in tone between a Steinway and a Chickering piano, being unable himself to detect it. A non-golfer is more likely than a habitual player to believe that all brands of golf balls are virtually alike. Hence, there is hardly any way that definition 1 of monopoly can be successfully used, for this definition depends on how we choose a homogeneous good, and this can never be decided by an economist. What constitutes a homogeneous commodity? That is, an industry, neckties, bow ties with polka dots, etc., or bow ties made by Jones. Only consumers will decide, and they, as different consumers, will be likely to decide differently in each concrete case. Use of definition 1, therefore, will probably reduce to the barren definition of monopoly as each man's exclusive ownership of his own property. And this, absurdly, would make every single person a monopolist. Oddly, despite the reams of literature on monopolies, very few economists have bothered to define monopoly, and these problems have therefore been overlooked. Joan Robinson, in the beginning of her famous Economics of Imperfect Competition, saw the difficulty and then evaded the issue throughout the rest of the book. She concedes that under careful analysis, either a monopoly would be defined as every producer's control over his own product, or monopoly could simply not exist on the free market at all. For competition exists among all products for the consumer's dollar, while very few articles are rigorously homogeneous. Mrs. Robinson then tries to evade the issue by falling back on common sense and defining monopoly as existing where there is a marked gap between the product and other substitutes the consumer may buy. But this will not do. Economics, in the first place, can establish no quantitative laws, so that there is nothing we can say about sizes of gaps. When does the gap become marked? Secondly, even if such laws were meaningful, there would be no way to measure the cross-elasticities of demands, the elasticity of substitution between the products, etc. These elasticities of substitution are changing all the time and could not be measured successfully even if they all remained constant, since supply conditions are always changing. No laboratory exists where all economic factors may be held fixed. After this point in her discussion, Mrs. Robinson practically forgets all about heterogeneity of product. Definition 1, then, is coherent, but highly inexpedient. Its usefulness is very limited, and the term has acquired highly charged emotional connotations from past use of quite different definitions. The term monopoly has sinister and evil connotations to most people. Monopolist is generally a word of abuse. To apply the term monopolist to at least the vast majority of the population, and perhaps to every man, would have a confusing and even ludicrous effect. The second definition is related to the first, but differs very significantly. It, in fact, was the original definition of monopoly, and the very definition responsible for its sinister connotations in the public mind. Let us turn to its classic expression by the great 17th-century jurist Lord Coke. A monopoly is an institution or allowance by the king, by his grant, commission, or otherwise, to any person or persons, bodies politic or corporate, for the sole buying, selling, making, working, or using of anything, whereby any person or persons, bodies politic or corporate, are sought to be restrained of any freedom or liberty that they had before, or hindered in their lawful trade. In other words, by this definition, monopoly is a grant of special privilege by the state, reserving a certain area of production to one particular individual or group. Entry into the field is prohibited to others, and this prohibition is enforced by the gendarmes of the state. This definition of monopoly goes back to the common law and acquired great political importance in England during the 16th and 17th centuries, when an historic struggle took place between libertarians and the crown over the issue of monopoly as opposed to freedom of production and enterprise. Under this definition of the term, it is not surprising that monopoly took on connotations of sinister interest and tyranny in the public mind. The enormous restrictions on production and trade, as well as the establishment by the state of a monopoly caste of favorites, were the objects of vehement attack for several centuries. The onrush of monopoly grants by Queen Elizabeth I and Charles I provoked resistance from even the Crown's subservient judges, and in 1624, Parliament declared that all monopolies are altogether contrary to the laws of this realm and are and shall be void. This anti-monopoly spirit was deeply ingrained in America, and the original Maryland Constitution declared that monopolies were odious and contrary to principles of commerce. That this definition was formerly important in economic analysis is clear in the following quotation from one of the first American economists, Francis Wayland. A monopoly is an exclusive right granted to a man, or to a monopoly of men, to employ their labor or capital in some particular manner. It is obvious that this type of monopoly can never arise on a free market, unhampered by state interference. In the free economy, then, according to this definition, there can be no monopoly problem. Many writers have objected that brand names and trademarks, generally considered as part of the free market, really constitute grants of special privilege by the state. No other firm can compete with Hershey Chocolates by producing its own product and calling it Hershey Chocolates. Is this not a state-imposed restriction on freedom of entry? And how can there be real freedom of entry under such conditions? This argument, however, completely misconceives the nature of liberty and of property. Every individual in the free society has a right to ownership of his own self and to the exclusive use of his own property. Included in his property is his name, the linguistic label which is uniquely his and is identified with him. A name is an essential part of a man's identity and therefore of his property. To say that he is a monopolist over his name is saying no more than that he is a monopolist over his own will or property, and such an extension of the word monopolist to every individual in the world would be an absurd usage of the term. The governmental function of defense of person and property, vital to the existence of a free society so long as any people are disposed to invade them, involves the defense of each person's particular name or trademark against the fraud of forgery or imposture. It means the outlawing of John Smith's pretending to be Joseph Williams, a prominent lawyer, and selling his own legal advice after stating to clients that he is selling that of Williams. This fraud is not only implicit theft of the consumer, but it is also abusing the property right of Joseph Williams to his unique name and individuality, and the use by some other chocolate firm of the Hershey label would be an equivalent perpetration of an invasive act of fraud and forgery. It might be objected that these concepts are vague and give rise to problems. Problems do arise, but they are not insuperable. Thus, if one man is named Joseph Williams, does this preclude anyone else from having the same name? And is any future Joseph Williams to be considered a criminal? The answer is clearly no, so long as there is no attempt by one to impersonate the other. In short, it is not so much the name per se which an individual owns, but the name as an affiliate of his person. Before adopting this definition of monopoly as the proper one, we must consider a final alternative, the defining of a monopolist as a person who has achieved a monopoly price, Definition 3. This definition has never been explicitly set forth, but it has been implicit in the most worthwhile of the neoclassical writings on this subject. It has the merit of focusing attention on the important economic question of monopoly price, its nature, and consequences. In this connection, we shall now investigate the neoclassical theory of monopoly price and inquire whether it really has the substance it seems at first glance to possess. B. The neoclassical theory of monopoly price. In previous sections, we have referred to a monopoly price as one established either by a monopolist or by a cartel of producers. At this point, we must investigate the theory more closely. A succinct definition of monopoly price has been supplied by Mises. If conditions are such that the monopolist can secure higher net proceeds by selling a smaller quantity of his product at a higher price than by selling a greater quantity of his supply at a lower price, there emerges a monopoly price, higher than the potential market price would have been in the absence of monopoly. The monopoly price doctrine may be summed up as follows. A certain quantity of a good, when produced and sold, yields a competitive price on the market. A monopolist or a cartel of firms can, if the demand is inelastic at the competitive price point, restrict sales and raise the price to arrive at the point of maximum returns. If, on the other hand, the demand as it presents itself to the monopolist or cartel is elastic at the competitive price point, the monopolist will not restrict sales to attain a higher price. As a result, as Mises points out, there is no need to be concerned with the monopolist in the sense of definition 1 above. Whether or not he is the sole producer of a commodity is unimportant and irrelevant for catalactic problems. It becomes important only if the configuration of his demand enables him to restrict sales and achieve a higher income at a monopoly price. Thus, as Mises puts it, the mere existence of a monopoly does not mean anything. The publisher of a copyright book is a monopolist, but he may not be able to sell a single copy, no matter how low the price he asks. Not every price at which a monopolist sells a monopolized commodity is a monopoly price. Monopoly prices are only prices at which it is more advantageous for the monopolist to restrict the total amount to be sold than to expand sales to the limit which a competitive market would allow. If he learns about the inelastic demand after he has erroneously produced too great a stock, the monopolist must destroy or withhold part of his stock. After that, he restricts production of the commodity to the most remunerative level. The inelastic demand giving rise to an opportunity to monopolize may present itself either to a single monopolist of a given product or to an industry as a whole when organized into a cartel of the different producers. In the latter case, the demand as it presents itself to each firm is elastic. At the competitive price, if one firm raises its price, the customers preponderantly shift to purchasing from its competitors. On the other hand, if the firms are cartelized, in many cases the lesser range of substitution by consumers would render the demand as presented to the cartel inelastic. C. Consequences of monopoly price theory. 1. The competitive environment. Before engaging in a critical analysis of the monopoly price theory itself, we might explore some of the consequences which do or do not follow from it. In this section, we for the moment assume that the monopoly price theory is valid. We are devoting space to analysis of monopoly price theory and its consequences because the theory, though invalid on the free market, will prove very useful in analyzing the consequences of monopoly grants by government. In the first place, it is not true that the monopolist, used here in the sense of definition 3, an obtainer of a monopoly price, is removed from the influence of competition or has the power to dictate to consumers at will. The best of the monopoly price theorists admit that the monopolist is as subject to the forces of competition as are other firms. The monopolist cannot set prices as high as he would like, being limited by the configurations of consumer demand. By definition, in fact, the demand as presented to the monopolist becomes elastic above the monopoly price point. By definition, the monopoly price point is that which maximizes the firm's or the cartel's income. Above that price, any further restriction of production and sales will lower the monopolist's monetary income. This implies that the demand will become elastic above that point, just as it is also elastic above the competitive price point when that is established on the market. Consumers make it elastic by their power of substituting purchases of other goods. Many other goods compete directly in their use value to the consumer. If some firm or combination of firms should, for example, achieve a monopoly price for cake soap, housewives can shift to detergents and thus limit the height of the monopoly price. But in addition, all goods without exception compete for the consumer's dollar or gold ounce. If the price of yachts becomes too high, the consumer can substitute expenditure on mansions, or he can substitute books for television sets, etc. As Mises warns, it would be a serious blunder to deduce from the antithesis between monopoly price and competitive price that the monopoly price is the outgrowth of the absence of competition. There is always catalactic competition on the market. Catalactic competition is no less a factor in the determination of monopoly prices than it is in the determination of competitive prices. The demand that makes the appearance of monopoly prices possible and directs the monopolist's conduct is determined by the competition of all other commodities competing for the buyer's dollars. The higher the monopolist fixes the price at which he is ready to sell, the more potential buyers turn their dollars toward other vendable goods. On the market, every commodity competes with all other commodities. Furthermore, as the market advances, as capital is invested and the market becomes more and more specialized, the demand for each product tends to become more and more elastic. As the market develops, the range of consumers' goods available increases enormously. The more consumers' goods are available, the more goods can be purchased by consumers, and the more elastic, ceteris paribus, the demand for each good will tend to be. As a result, the opportunities for the establishment of monopoly prices will tend to diminish as the market and capitalist methods develop. 2. Monopoly profit versus monopoly gain to a factor. Many monopoly price theorists have declared that establishment of the monopoly price means that the monopolist is able to attain permanent monopoly profits. This is then contrasted with competitive profits and losses, which, as we have seen, disappear in the evenly rotating economy. Under competition, if one firm is seen to be making great profits in a particular productive process, other firms rush in to take advantage of the anticipated opportunities, and the profits disappear. But in the case of the monopolist, it is asserted, his unique position allows him to keep making these profits permanently. We are not discussing here the generally conceded point that monopoly profits are capitalized in capital gains to the shares of the firm's stock. To use such terminology is to misconceive the nature of profit and loss. Profits and losses are purely the results of entrepreneurial activity, and that activity is the consequence of the uncertainty of the future. Entrepreneurship is the action on the market that takes advantage of estimated discrepancies between selling prices and buying prices of factors. The better forecasters make profits, and the incorrect ones suffer losses. In the evenly rotating economy, where everyone has settled down to an unchanging round of activity, there can be no profit or loss because there is no uncertainty on the market. The same is true for the monopolist. In the evenly rotating economy, he obtains his specific monopoly gain not as an entrepreneur, but as the owner of the product which he sells. His monopoly gain is an added income to his monopolized product. Whether for an individual or for a cartel, it is this product which earns more income through restriction of its supply. The question arises, why cannot other entrepreneurs seize the gainful opportunity and enter into the production of this good, thereby tending to eliminate the opportunity? In the case of the cartel, this is precisely the tendency that will always prevail and lead to the breakup of a monopoly price position. Even if new firms entering the industry are bought off by being offered quotal positions in the old cartel, and both the new and the old firms have been able to agree on allocations of production and income, such actions will not suffice to preserve the cartel, for new firms will be tempted to acquire a share in the monopoly gains, and ever more will be created until the entire cartel operation is rendered unprofitable, there being too many firms to share the benefits. In such situations, the pressure will become greater and greater for the more efficient firms to cut loose from the cartel and to refuse further to provide a comfortable shelter for the host of inefficient firms. In the case of a single monopolist, either his brand name and unique goodwill with the consumers prevents others from taking away his monopoly gains, or else he is a recipient of special monopoly privilege from the government, in which case other producers are prevented by force from producing the same good. Our analysis of monopoly gain must be pursued further. We have said that the gain is derived from income from the sale of a certain product, but this product must be produced by factors, and we have seen that the return to any product is resolved into returns to the factors which produce it. Such imputation in the market must also take place for monopoly gains. Let us say, for example, that the Staunton Washing Machine Company has been able to achieve a monopoly price for its product. It is clear that the monopoly gain cannot be attributed to the machines, the plant, etc., which produce the washers. If the Staunton Company bought these machines from other producers, then any monopoly gains would, in the long run, as the machines were replaced, accrue to the producers of the machines. In the evenly rotating economy, where entrepreneurial profits and losses disappear, and the price of a product equals the sum of the prices of its factors, all the monopoly gain would accrue to a factor and not a product. Furthermore, no income except time income could accrue to the owner of a capital good, because every capital good must, in turn, be produced by higher order factors. Ultimately, all capital goods are resolvable into labor, land, and time factors. But if the Staunton Washing Machine Company cannot itself achieve a monopoly gain from a monopoly price, then obviously it does not benefit by restricting production in order to obtain this gain. Therefore, just as no income in the evenly rotating economy can accrue specifically to owners of capital goods, neither can specific monopoly gains. The monopoly gains must then be imputed to either labor or land factors. In the case of a brand name, for example, a certain kind of labor factor is being monopolized. A name, as we have seen, is a unique identifying label for a person or a group of persons acting cooperatively, and is therefore an attribute of the person and his energy. Considered generally, labor is the term designating the productive efforts of personal energy, whatever its concrete content. A brand name, therefore, is an attribute of a labor factor, specifically the owner or owners of the firm. Or, considered catalactically, the brand name represents the decision-making rent accruing to the owner and his name. If a monopoly price is achieved by the baseball prowess of Mickey Mantle, this is a specific monopoly gain attributable to a labor factor. In both of these cases, then, the monopoly price stems not simply from the unique possession of the final product, but more basically from the unique possession of one of the factors necessary to the final product. A monopoly gain might also be imputable to ownership of a unique natural resource or land factor. Thus, a monopoly price for diamonds may be attributable to a monopoly of diamond mines, from which diamonds must be ultimately produced. Under the analysis of monopoly price, then, there cannot be, in the evenly rotating system, any such thing as monopoly profits. There are only specific monopoly income gains to owners of labor or land factors. No monopoly gain can accrue to an owner of a capital good. If a monopoly price has been imposed because of a grant of monopoly privilege by the state, then obviously the monopoly gain is attributable to this special privilege. To attain a monopoly price, the factor owner must meet two conditions. A. He must be a monopolist, in the sense of definition 1, over the factor. If he were not, the monopoly gain could be bid away by competitors entering the field. And B. The demand for the factor must be inelastic above the competitive price point. 3. A world of monopoly prices? Is it possible, within the framework of monopoly price theory, to assert that all prices on the free market may be monopoly prices? This is the underlying assumption in Mrs. Joan Robinson's Economics of Imperfect Competition. Can all selling prices be monopoly prices? There are two ways in which we may analyze this problem. One is by turning our attention to the monopolized industry. As we have seen, the industry with a monopoly price restricts production in that industry, either by a cartel or a single firm, thereby releasing non-specific factors to enter other fields of production. But it is evidently impossible to conceive of a world of monopoly prices, because this would imply a piling up of unused non-specific factors. Since wants do not remain unfulfilled, labor and other non-specific factors will be used somewhere, and the industries that acquire more factors and produce more cannot be monopoly price industries. Their prices will be below the competitive price level. We may also consider consumer demand. We have seen that a necessary condition for the establishment of monopoly price is a consumer's demand schedule inelastic above the competitive price point. Obviously, it is impossible for every industry to have such an inelastic demand schedule. For the definition of inelastic is that consumers will spend a greater total sum of money on the good when the price is higher. But consumers have a certain given total stock of money assets and money income, as well as a given amount at any one time which they may allocate to consumption spending. If they spend more on a certain good, they have less to spend on other goods. Therefore, they cannot spend more on every good, and not all prices can be monopoly prices. There can never, then, be a world of monopoly prices, even assuming monopoly price theory. Because of the fixity of consumers' monetary stock and the employment of displaced factors, monopoly prices could not be established in more than approximately half of the economy's industries. 4. Cutthroat competition. A popular theme in the literature is the alleged evil of cutthroat competition. Curiously, cutthroat or excessive competition is linked by critics to the achievement of a monopoly price. The usual charge is that a big firm, for example, deliberately sells below the most profitable price, even to the extent of suffering losses. The firm acts so peculiarly in order to force another firm producing the same product to cut its price also. The stronger firm, with the capital resources to endure the losses, then drives the weaker firm out of business and establishes a monopoly of the field. But first, what is wrong with such a monopoly? Definition 1. What is wrong with the fact that the firm more efficient in serving the consumer remains in business, while consumers refuse to patronize the inefficient firm? A firm suffering losses signifies that it is not as successful as other firms in serving consumer desires. Factors then shift from the inefficient to the efficient firms. A firm's going out of business harms no owner of any factor it employs and injures only the entrepreneur who miscalculated in his advance production decisions. A firm goes out of business precisely because it suffers entrepreneurial losses. That is, its monetary revenues in sales to consumers are less than the money it paid out previously to owners of factors. But so much money had to be paid out for factors, that is, costs were so high, because these factors could earn as much money elsewhere. If this entrepreneur cannot profitably employ the factors at their given prices, the reason is that factor owners can sell their services to other firms. Insofar as factors may be specific to the firm, and to the extent that their owners will accept a reduced price and income as the price of the firm's product is reduced, total money costs can be reduced, and the firm can be maintained in operation. Therefore, failure by business firms is due solely to entrepreneurial error in forecasting and to entrepreneurial inability to secure the factors of production by outbidding those firms more successful in serving the consumer. Bidding takes place among numerous firms in various industries, not only among firms in the same industry. Thus, the elimination of inefficient firms cannot harm factor owners or lead to their unemployment, since their failure was due precisely to the more attractive competing bids made by other firms, or in some cases, to the alternatives of leisure or production outside the market. Their failure also helps consumers by transferring resources from wasteful to efficient producers. It is largely the entrepreneurs who suffer from their own errors, errors incurred through their own voluntarily adopted risks. It is curious that the critics of cutthroat competition are generally the same as those who complain about the market's subversion of consumers' sovereignty. For selling a product at very low prices, even at short-term losses, is a bonanza to the consumers, and there is no reason why this gift to the consumers should be deplored. Furthermore, if the consumers were really indignant about this form of competition, they would scornfully refuse to accept this gift and instead continue to patronize the allegedly victimized competitor. When they do not do so, and instead rush to acquire the bargains, they are indicating their perfect contentment with this state of affairs. From the point of view of consumers' sovereignty or individual sovereignty, there is nothing at all wrong with cutthroat competition. The only conceivable problem is the one usually cited— that after the single firm has driven everyone else out of business through sustained selling at very low prices, then the final monopolist will restrict sales and raise its price to a monopoly price. Even granting for a moment the tenability of the monopoly price concept, this does not seem a very likely occurrence. In the first place, it is time enough to complain after the monopoly price is established, especially since we have seen that we cannot consider monopoly per se, definition 1, as an evil. An amusing instance of this concern is this argument for compulsory legal cartelization by West German industrialists, that the so-called unrestricted competition would produce a catastrophe in which the stronger industries would destroy the weaker and establish themselves as monopolies. Create an inefficient monopoly now to avoid an efficient monopoly later. Secondly, a firm will not always be able to achieve a monopoly price. In all such cases, including A, where not all the other firms in the industry can be driven out, or B, where the demand is such that the monopolist cannot achieve a monopoly price, the cutthroat competition is then a pure boon with no harmful effects. Incidentally, it is by no means true that the large firms will always be the strongest in a price-cutting war. Often, depending on the concrete conditions, it is the smaller, more mobile firm, not burdened with heavy investments, that is able to cut its costs, particularly when its factors are more specific to it, such as the labor of its management, and outcompete the larger firm. In such cases, of course, there is no monopoly price problem whatever. The fact that the lowly pushcart peddler for centuries has been set upon by governmental violence at the behest of his more lordly and heavily capitalized competitors bears witness to the practical possibilities of such a situation. What of the allegedly vast financial power of a big firm, rendering it impervious to cost? In a brilliant article, Professor Wayne Lehman has pointed out that a larger firm will also have larger volume and will therefore suffer greater losses when selling below cost. Having a larger volume, it has more to lose. What is relevant, therefore, is not the absolute size of the financial resources of the competing firms, but the size of their resources in relation to their volume of sales and expenditures, and this changes the conventional picture drastically. Suppose, however, that after this lengthy and costly process, a firm has finally been able to achieve a monopoly price by the route of cutthroat competition. What is there to prevent this monopoly gain from attracting other entrepreneurs who will try to undercut the existing firm and achieve some of the gain for themselves? What is to prevent new firms from coming in and driving the price down to competitive levels again? Is the firm to resume cutthroat competition and the same deliberate losing process once more? In that case, we are likely to find that consumers of the good will be receiving gifts far more often than facing a monopoly price. After investigating conditions in the retail gasoline industry, one particularly subject to allegedly cutthroat competition, economist Harold Fleming declared, "Some people think that leading marketers occasionally reduce prices to drive out competition so that they may later enjoy a monopoly. But as one oil man has put it, that is like trying to sweep back the ocean to get a dry place to sit down. Competitors never scare and never hesitate for long and would move in immediately when prices were restored, offering little opportunity to a single marketer to recoup his losses." Professor Lehman has pointed out that the smaller firm, driven out by cutthroat competition, may simply close down, wait for the larger firm to reap its expected gain of a higher monopoly price, and then reopen. More important, even if the small firm is driven into bankruptcy, its physical plant remains intact, and it may be bought by a new entrepreneur at bargain prices. As a result, the new firm will be able to produce at very low cost and damage the victor firm considerably. To avoid this threat, the big firm would have to delay raising its price for the very long time required for the small plant to wear out or become obsolete. Lehman also demonstrates that the big firm could not keep new small firms out by a mere threat of cutthroat competition, for A, new firms will probably interpret the high price charged by the monopolist as a sign of inefficiency, providing a ripe opportunity for profits, and B, the monopolist can demonstrate his power satisfactorily only by actually selling at low prices for long periods of time. Hence, only by keeping its costs down and its prices low, that is, by not extracting a monopoly price, can the victor firm keep out potential rivals. But this means that the cutthroat competition, far from being a route to a monopoly price, was a pure gift to consumers and a pure loss to the victor. A leading oil executive told Lehman, "We have invested too much in plant and equipment in this area to want to invite in a host of competitors under an umbrella of high prices." But what of a standard problem brought forward by critics of cutthroat competition? Cannot the big firm check the entry of efficient small firms by simply buying up the new rival's plant and putting it out of production? Perhaps a short period of cutthroat price cutting will convince the new small firm of the advantage of selling out and will permit the monopolist to avoid the long periods of losses just mentioned. No one seems to realize, however, the high costs such buying will entail. Lehman points out that the really efficient small firm can demand such a high price for its assets as to make the whole procedure prohibitively expensive. And further, any later attempt by the large firm to recoup its losses by charging the monopoly price will only invite new entry by other firms and redouble the expensive buying out process again and again. Buying out competitors, then, will be even more costly than simple cutthroat competition, which we have seen to be unprofitable. Lehman points out in a striking refutation of one of the myths of our age that this is precisely what happened to John D. Rockefeller. According to a widely accepted view, he softened up small competitors in the oil business by a period of intensive price competition, bought them out for a song, and then raised prices to consumers to make up his losses. Actually, the softening up process did not work, for Rockefeller usually ended up paying so handsomely that the sellers, often in violation of promises made, proceeded to build another plant for its nuisance value, hoping again to collect a reward from their benefactor. Rockefeller, after a time, got tired of paying blackmail and decided that the best way to hold the dominant position he wanted was to keep profit margins small all the time. Lehman concludes quite correctly that large rather than small firms dominate many markets not as a result of victorious cutthroat competition and monopolistic pricing, but by taking advantage of the low costs of much large-scale production and keeping prices low in fear of potential as well as actual rivals. A final argument against the doctrines of cutthroat competition is that it is impossible to determine whether it is taking place or not. The fact that a monopoly might ensue afterward does not even establish the motive, and is certainly no criterion of cutthroat procedures. One proposed criterion has been selling below costs, most cogently below what is usually termed variable costs, the expenses of using factors in production, assuming previously sunk investment in a fixed plant. But this is no criterion at all. As we have already declared, there is no such thing as costs, apart from speculation on a higher future price, once the stock has been produced. Costs take place along the path of decisions to produce, at each step along the way that investments of money and effort are made in factors. The allocations, the opportunities foregone, take place at each step as future production decisions must be taken and commitments made. Once the stock has been produced, however, and there is no expectation of a price rise, the sale is costless, since there are no advantages foregone by selling the product, costs in making the sale being here considered negligible for purposes of simplification. Therefore, the stock will tend to be sold at whatever price is obtainable. There is no such thing, then, as selling below costs on stock already produced. The cutting of price may just as well be due to inability to dispose of stock at any higher price as to cutthroat competition, and it is impossible for an observer to separate the two elements. D. The illusion of monopoly price on the unhampered market. Up to this point, we have explained the neoclassical theory of monopoly price and have pointed out various misconceptions about its consequences. We have also shown that there is nothing bad about monopoly price and that it constitutes no infringement on any legitimate interpretation of individuals' sovereignty or even of consumers' sovereignty. Yet there has been a great deficiency in the economic literature on this whole issue, a failure to realize the illusion in the entire concept of monopoly price. If we turn to the definition of monopoly price, we find that there is assumed to be a competitive price to which a higher monopoly price, an outcome of restrictive action, is contrasted. Yet, if we analyze the matter closely, it becomes evident that the entire contrast is an illusion. In the market, there is no discernible, identifiable competitive price, and therefore there is no way of distinguishing, even conceptually, any given price as a monopoly price. The alleged competitive price can be identified neither by the producer himself nor by the disinterested observer. Let us take a firm which is considering the production of a certain good. The firm can be a monopolist in the sense of producing a unique good, or it can be an oligopolist among a few firms. Whatever its position, it is irrelevant, because we are interested only in whether or not it can achieve a monopoly price as compared to a competitive price. This, in turn, depends on the elasticity of the demand as it is presented to the firm over a certain range. The producer must decide how much of the good to produce and sell in a future period, that is, at the time when this demand will become relevant. He will set his output at whatever point is expected to maximize his monetary earnings, other psychic factors being equal, taking into consideration the necessary monetary expenses of production for each quantity, that is, the amounts that can be produced for each amount of money invested. As an entrepreneur, he will attempt to maximize profits. As a labor owner, to maximize his monetary income, as a landowner, to maximize his monetary income from that factor. On the basis of this logic of action, the producer sets his investment to produce a certain stock, or as a factor owner, to sell a certain amount of service. Assuming that he has correctly estimated his demand, the intersection of the two will establish the market equilibrium price. The critical question is this: is the market price a competitive price or a monopoly price? The answer is that there is no way of knowing. Contrary to the assumptions of the theory, there is no competitive price which is clearly established somewhere and which we may compare it with. Neither does the elasticity of the demand establish any criterion. Even if all the difficulties of discovering and identifying the demand were waived, and this identifying can be done, of course, only by the producer himself and only in a tentative fashion, we have seen that the price, if accurately estimated, will always be set by the seller so that the range above the market price will be elastic. How is anyone, including the producer himself, to know whether or not this market price is competitive or monopoly? Suppose that the producer decides that he will make more money if he produces less of the good in the next period. Is the higher price to be gained from such a cutback necessarily a monopoly price? Why could it not just as well be a movement from a sub-competitive price to a competitive price? In the real world, a demand is not simply given to a producer, but must be estimated and discovered. If a producer has produced too much in one period, and in order to earn more income, produces less in the next period, this is all that can be said about the action. For there is no criterion that will determine whether or not he is moving from a price below the alleged competitive price or moving above this price. Thus, we cannot use restriction of production as the test of monopoly versus competitive price. A movement from a sub-competitive to a competitive price also involves a restriction of production of this good, coupled, of course, with an expansion of production in other lines by the released factors. There is no way whatever to distinguish such a restriction and corollary expansion from the alleged monopoly price situation. If the restriction is accompanied by increased leisure for the owner of a labor factor rather than increased production of some other good on the market, it is still an expansion of the yield of a consumer's good, leisure. There is still no way of determining whether the restriction resulted in a monopoly or a competitive price, or to what extent the motive of increased leisure was involved. To define a monopoly price as a price attained by selling a smaller quantity of a product at a higher price is therefore meaningless, since the same definition applies to the competitive price as compared with a subcompetitive price. There is no way to define monopoly price because there is also no way of defining the competitive price to which the former must refer. Many writers have attempted to establish some criterion for distinguishing a monopoly price from a competitive price. Some call the monopoly price that price achieving permanent long-run monopoly profits for a firm. This is contrasted to the competitive price, at which, in the evenly rotating economy, profits disappear. Yet, as we have already seen, there are never permanent monopoly profits, but only monopoly gains to owners of land or labor factors. Money costs to the entrepreneur who must buy factors of production will tend to equal money revenues in the evenly rotating economy, whether the price is competitive or monopoly. The monopoly gains, however, are secured as income to labor or land factors. There is, therefore, never any identifiable element that could provide a criterion of the absence of monopoly gain. With a monopoly gain, the factor's income is greater. Without it, it is less. But where is the criterion for distinguishing this from a change in the income of a factor for legitimate demand and supply reasons? How to distinguish a monopoly gain from a simple increase in factor income? Another theory attempts to define a monopoly gain as income to a factor greater than that received by another similar factor. Thus, if Mickey Mantle receives a greater monetary income than another outfielder, that difference represents the monopoly gain resulting from his natural monopoly of unique ability. The crucial difficulty with this approach is that it implicitly adopts the old classical fallacy of treating all the various labor factors, as well as all the various land factors, as somehow homogeneous. If all the labor factors are somehow one good, then the variations in income accruing to each must be explained by reference to some sort of monopolistic or other mysterious element. Yet a good with a homogeneous supply is only a good if all its units are interchangeable, as we saw at the beginning of this work. But the very fact that Mantle and the other outfielder are treated differently in the market signifies that they are selling different, not the same, goods. Just as in tangible commodities, so in personal labor services, whether sold to other producers or to consumers directly, each seller may be selling a unique good. And yet he is competing with more or less close substitutability against all the other sellers for the purchases of consumers or lower-order producers. But since each good or service is unique, we cannot state that the difference between the prices of any two represents any sort of monopoly price. Monopoly price vis-à-vis competitive price can refer only to alternative prices of the same good. Mickey Mantle may indeed be a person of unique ability and a monopolist, as is everyone else, over the disposition of his own talents, but whether or not he is achieving a monopoly price, and therefore a monopoly gain from his service, can never be determined. This analysis is equally applicable to land. It is just as illegitimate to dub the difference between the income of the site of the Empire State Building and that of a rural general store a monopoly gain as to apply the same concept to the additional income of Mickey Mantle. The fact that both areas are land makes them no more homogeneous on the market than the fact that Mickey Mantle and Joe Doakes are both baseball players, or, in a broader category, both laborers. The fact that each is remunerated at a different price and income signifies that they are considered different on the market. To treat differential gains for different goods as instances of monopoly gain is to render the term completely devoid of significance. Neither is the attempt to establish the existence of idle resources as a criterion of monopolistic withholding of factors any more valid. Idle labor resources will always mean increased leisure, and therefore the leisure motive will always be intertwined with any alleged monopolistic motive. It therefore becomes impossible to separate them. The existence of idle land may always be due to the fact of the relative scarcity of labor as compared with available land. This relative scarcity makes it more serviceable to consumers, and hence more remunerative, to invest labor in certain areas of land and not in others. The land areas least productive of potential earnings will be forced to lie idle, the amount depending on how much labor supply is available. We must stress that all land, that is, every nature-given resource, is involved here, including urban sites and natural resources as well as agricultural areas. The allocation of labor to land is comparable to Crusoe's having to decide on which plot of ground to build his shelter or in which stream to fish. Because of the natural as well as voluntary limitations on his labor effort, that area of land on which he produces the highest utility will be cultivated, and the rest will be left idle. This element also cannot be separated from any alleged monopolistic element, for if someone objects that the withheld land is of the same quality as the land in use, and therefore that monopolistic restriction is afoot, it may always be answered that the two pieces of land necessarily differ in location, if in no other attribute, and that the very fact that the two are treated differently on the market tends to confirm this difference. By what mystical criterion, then, does some outsider assert that the two lands are economically identical? In the case of capital goods, it is also true that the limitations of available labor supply will often make idle those goods which are expected to yield a lesser return as compared with other capital that can be employed by labor. The difference here is that idle capital goods are always the result of previous error by producers, since no such idleness would be necessary if the present events, demands, prices, supplies, had all been forecast correctly by all the producers. But though error is always unfortunate, the keeping idle of unremunerative capital is the best course to follow. It is making the best of the existing situation, not of the situation that would have obtained if foresight had been perfect. In the evenly rotating economy, of course, there would never be idle capital goods. There would be only idle land and idle labor, to the extent that leisure is voluntarily preferred to money income. In no case is it possible to establish an identification of purely monopolistic withholding action. A similar proposed criterion for distinguishing a monopoly price from a competitive price runs as follows. In the competitive case, the marginal factor produces no rent. In the monopoly price case, however, use of the monopolized factor is restricted so that its marginal use does yield a rent. We may answer in the first place that there is no reason to say that every factor will, in the competitive case, always be worked until it yields no rent. On the contrary, every factor is worked in a region of diminishing but positive marginal product, not zero product. Indeed, as we have shown, if the value product of a unit of a factor is zero, it will not be used at all. Every unit of a factor is used because it yields a value product. Otherwise, it would not be used in production. And if it yields a value product, it will earn its discounted value product in income. It is clear further that this criterion could never be applied to a monopolized labor factor. What labor factor earns a zero wage in a competitive market? Yet many monopolized, definition 1, factors are labor factors, such as brand names, unique services, decision-making ability in business, etc. Land is more abundant than labor, and therefore some lands will be idle and receive zero rent. Even here, however, it is only the sub-marginal lands that receive no rent. The marginal lands in use receive some rent, however small. Furthermore, even if it were true that marginal lands received zero rent, this would be irrelevant for our discussion. It would apply only to poorer or inferior as compared with more productive lands. But a criterion of monopoly or competitive price must apply not to factors of different quality, but to homogeneous factors. The monopoly price problem is one of a supply of units of one homogeneous factor, not of various different factors within the one broad category, land. In this case, as we have stated, every factor will earn some value product in a diminishing zone, and not zero. In the case of depletable natural resources, any allocation of use necessarily involves the use of some of the resource in the present, even considering the resource as homogeneous, and the withholding of the remainder for allocation to future use. But there is no way of conceptually distinguishing such withholding from monopolistic withholding, and therefore of discussing a monopoly price. Since in the competitive case, all factors in use will earn some rent, there is still no basis for distinguishing a competitive from a monopoly price. Another very common attempt to distinguish between a competitive and a monopoly price rests on the alleged ideal of marginal cost pricing. Failure to set prices equal to marginal cost is considered an example of monopoly behavior. There are several fatal errors in this analysis. In the first place, as we shall see further, there can be no such thing as pure competition, that hypothetical state in which the demand for the output of a firm is infinitely elastic. Only in this never-never land does price equal marginal cost in equilibrium. Otherwise, marginal cost equals marginal revenue in the ERE, that is, the revenue that a given increment of cost will yield to the firm. Only if the demand were perfectly elastic would marginal revenue boil down to average revenue or price. There is now no way of distinguishing competitive from monopolistic situations, since marginal cost will, in all cases, tend to equal marginal revenue. Secondly, this equality is only a tendency that results from competition. It is not a precondition of competition. It is a property of the equilibrium of the ERE that the market economy always tends toward but never can reach. To uphold it as a welfare ideal for the real world, an ideal with which to gauge existing conditions, as so many economists have done, is to misconceive completely the nature of the market and of economics itself. Thirdly, there is no reason why firms should ever deliberately balk at being guided by marginal cost considerations. Their aiming at maximum net revenue will see to that. But there is no one simple determinate marginal cost because, as we have seen, there is no one identifiable short-run period such as is assumed by current theory. The firm faces a gamut of variable periods of time for the investment and use of factors, and its pricing and output decisions depend on the future period of time which it is considering. Is it buying a new machine, or is it selling old output piled up in inventory? The marginal cost considerations will differ in the two cases. It is clear that it is impossible to distinguish competitive or monopolistic behavior on the part of a firm. It is no more possible to speak of monopoly price in the case of a cartel. In the first place, a cartel, when it sets the amount of its production in advance for the next period, is in exactly the same position as the single firm. It sets the amount of its production at that point which it believes will maximize its monetary earnings. There is still no way of distinguishing a monopoly from a competitive or a subcompetitive price. Furthermore, we have seen that there is no essential difference between a cartel and a merger, or between a merger of producers with money assets and a merger of producers with previously existing capital assets to form a partnership or corporation. As a result of the tradition, still in evidence in the literature, of identifying a firm with a single individual entrepreneur or producer, we tend to overlook the fact that most existing firms are constituted through the voluntary merging of monetary assets. To pursue the similarity further, suppose that firm A wishes to expand its production. Is there an essential difference between its buying new land and building a new plant and its purchasing an old plant owned by another firm? Yet the latter case, if the plant constitutes all the assets of firm B, will involve, in fact, a merger of the two firms. The degree of merger or the degree of independence in the various parts of the productive system will depend entirely upon the most remunerative method for the producers concerned. This will also be the method most serviceable to the consumers, and there is no way of distinguishing between a cartel, a merger, and one larger firm. It might be objected at this point that there are many useful, indeed indispensable, theoretical concepts which cannot be practically isolated in their pure form in the real world. Thus, the interest rate, in practice, is not strictly separable from profits, and the various components of the interest rate are not separable in practice, but they can be separated in analysis. But these concepts are each definable in terms independent of one another and of the complex reality being investigated. Thus, the pure interest rate may never exist in practice, but the market interest rate is theoretically analyzable into its components: pure interest rate, price expectation component, risk component. They are so analyzable because each of these components is definable independently of the complex market interest rate, and, moreover, is independently deducible from the axioms of praxeology. The existence and determination of the pure interest rate is strictly deducible from the principles of human action, time preference, etc. Each of these components, then, is arrived at a priori in relation to the concrete market interest rate itself, and is deduced from previously established truths about human action. In all such cases, the components are definable through independently established theoretical criteria. In this case, however, there is, as we have seen, no independent way by which we can define and distinguish a monopoly price from a competitive price. There is no prior rule available to guide us in framing the distinction. To say that the monopoly price is formed when the configuration of demand is inelastic above the competitive price tells us nothing, because we have no way of independently defining the competitive price. To reiterate, the seemingly unidentifiable elements in other areas of economic theory are independently deducible from the axioms of human action. Time preference, uncertainty, changes in purchasing power, etc., can all be independently established by prior reasoning, and their interrelations analyzed through the method of mental constructions. The evenly rotating economy can be seen as the ever-moving goal of the market through our analysis of the direction of action. But here, all that we know from prior analysis of human action is that individuals cooperate on the market to sell and purchase factors, transform them into products, and expect to sell the products to others, eventually to final consumers, and that the factors are sold and entrepreneurs undertake the production in order to obtain monetary income from the sale of their product. How much any given person will produce of any given good or service is determined by his expectations of greatest monetary income, other psychic considerations being equal. But nowhere in the analysis of such action is it possible to separate conceptually an alleged restrictive from a non-restrictive act. And nowhere is it possible to define competitive price in any way that would differ from the free market price. Similarly, there is no way of conceptually distinguishing monopoly price from free market price. But if a concept has no possible grounding in reality, then it is an empty and illusory, and not a meaningful concept. On the free market, there is no way of distinguishing a monopoly price from a competitive price or a subcompetitive price, or of establishing any changes as movements from one to the other. No criteria can be found for making such distinctions. The concept of monopoly price as distinguished from competitive price is therefore untenable. We can speak only of the free market price. Thus, we conclude not only that there is nothing wrong with monopoly price, but also that the entire concept is meaningless. There is a great deal of monopoly in the sense of a single owner of a unique commodity or service, definition 1, but we have seen that this is an inappropriate term, and further that it has no catalactic significance. A monopoly would be of importance only if it led to a monopoly price, and we have seen that there is no such thing as a monopoly price or a competitive price on the market. There is only the free market price. E. Some problems in the theory of the illusion of monopoly price. 1. Location monopoly. It might be objected that in the case of location monopoly, a monopoly price can be distinguished from a competitive price on a free market. Let us consider the case of cement. There are cement consumers, say, who live in Rochester. A cement firm in Rochester could competitively charge a mill price of X gold grams per ton. The nearest competitor is stationed in Albany, and freight costs from Albany to Rochester are 3 gold grams per ton. The Rochester firm is then able to increase its price to obtain X plus 2 gold grams per ton from Rochester consumers. Does its locational advantage not confer upon it a monopoly, and is not this higher price a monopoly price? First, as we have seen, the good that we must consider is the good in the hands of the consumers. The Rochester firm is superior locationally for the Rochester market. The fact that the Albany firm cannot compete is not to be blamed on the Rochester firm. Location is also a factor of production. Furthermore, another firm could, if it wished, set itself up in Rochester to compete. Let us, however, be generous to the location monopoly theorists and grant that, in a sense, definition 1, this monopoly is enjoyed by all individual sellers of any good or service. This is due to the eternal law of human action, and indeed of all matter, that only one thing can be in one place at one time. The retail grocer on 5th Street enjoys a monopoly of the sale of groceries for that street. The grocer on 4th Street enjoys a monopoly of grocery service for his street, etc. In the case of stores which all cluster together in the same block, say radio stores, there are still a few feet of sidewalk over which each owner of a radio store exercises a location monopoly. Location is as specific to a firm or plant as ability is to a person. Whether this element of location takes on any importance in the market depends on the configuration of consumer demand and on which policy is most profitable for each seller in the concrete case. In some cases, a grocer, for example, can charge higher prices for his goods than another because of his monopoly of the block. In that case, his monopoly over the good eggs available on 5th Street has taken on such a significance for the consumers in his block that he can charge them a higher price than the 4th Street grocer and still retain their patronage. In other cases, he cannot do so, because the bulk of his customers will desert him for the neighboring grocer if the latter's prices are lower. Now, a good is homogeneous if consumers evaluate its units in the same way. If that condition holds, its units will be sold for a uniform price on the market, or rapidly tend to be sold at a uniform price. If now various grocers must adhere to a uniform price, then there is no location monopoly. But what of the case where the Fifth Street grocer can charge a higher price than his competitor? Do we not have here a clear case of an identifiable monopoly price? Can we not say that the Fifth Street grocer who can charge more than his competitor for the same goods has found that the demand for his products is inelastic for a certain range above the competitive price, the competitive price being taken as that equal to the price charged by his neighbor? Can we not say this even though we recognize that there is no infringement on consumers' sovereignty in this action, since it is due to the specific tastes of his consuming customers? The answer is an emphatic no. The reason is that the economist can never equate a good with some physical substance. A good, we remember, is a quantity of a thing divisible into a supply of homogeneous units, and this homogeneity, we repeat, must be in the minds of the consuming public, not in its physical composition. If a malted milk consumed at a luncheonette is the same good in the minds of consumers as the malted at a fashionable restaurant, then the price of the malted will be the same in both places. On the other hand, we have seen that the consumer buys not only the physical good, but all attributes of a thing, including its name, the wrappings, and the atmosphere in which it is consumed. If most of the consumers differentiate sufficiently between food consumed in the restaurant and food consumed at the luncheonette, so that a higher price can be charged in one case than in the other, then the food is a different good in each case. A malted consumed in the restaurant becomes, for a significant body of consumers, a different good from a malted consumed at the luncheonette. The same situation obtains for brand names, even in those situations where a minority of the consumers do regard several brands as actually the same good. As long as the bulk of the consumers regard them as different goods, then they are different goods, and their prices will differ. Similarly, goods may differ physically, but as long as they are regarded by consumers as the same, they are the same good. The same analysis applies to the case of location, where the Fifth Street consumers regard groceries at Fifth Street as a significantly better good than groceries at Fourth Street, so that they are willing to pay more rather than walk the extra distance. Then the two will become different goods. In the case of location, there will always be a tendency for the two to be different goods, but very often this will not be significant on the market. For a consumer may and almost always will prefer groceries available on this block to groceries available on the next block, but often this preference will not be enough to overcome any higher price for the former goods. If the bulk of the consumers shift to the latter good at a higher price, the two on the market will be the same good. And it is action on the market, real action, that we are interested in, not the non-significant pure valuations by themselves. In praxeology, we are interested only in preferences that result in, and are therefore demonstrated by, real choices, not in the preferences themselves. A good cannot be independently established as such apart from consumer preference on the market. Groceries on Fifth Street may be higher in price than groceries on Fourth Street to the Fifth Street consumers. If so, it will be because the former is a different good to the consumers. In the same way, Rochester cement may cost more than Albany cement in Albany to Rochester consumers, but the two are different goods by virtue of their difference in location, and there is no way of determining whether or not the price in Rochester or on Fifth Street is a monopoly price or a competitive price, or of determining what the competitive price might be. It certainly could not be the price charged by the other firm elsewhere, since these prices are really for two different goods. There is no theoretical criterion by which we can distinguish simple locational income to sites from alleged monopoly income to sites. There is another reason for abandoning any theory of locational monopoly price. If all sites are purely specific in locational value, there is no sense to the statement that they earn a monopoly rent. For monopoly price, according to the theory, can be established only by selling less of a good and thus commanding a higher price. But all locational properties of a site differ in quality because they differ in location, and therefore there can be no restriction of sales to part of a site. Either a site is in production or it is idle, but the idle sites necessarily differ in location from the sites in use, and are therefore idle because their value productivity is inferior. They are idle because they are submarginal, not because they are monopolistically withheld parts of a certain homogeneous supply. The locational monopoly price theorist, then, is refuted whichever way he turns. If he takes a limited view of locational monopoly in the sense of definition 1 and confines it to such examples as Rochester versus Albany, he can never establish a criterion for monopoly price, for another firm can enter Rochester, either actually or potentially, to bid away any locational profit that the first firm may earn. His prices cannot be compared with those of his competitors because they are selling different goods. If the theorist takes an extensive view of locational monopoly, which would take into consideration the fact that every location necessarily differs from every other, and compares locations a few feet apart, then there is no sense at all in talking of monopoly price. For A, the price of a product at one location cannot be precisely compared with another because they are different goods, and B, each site is different in locational quality, and therefore no site can be conceptually split up into different homogeneous units, some to be sold and some to be withheld from the market. Each site is a unit in itself, but such a splitting is essential for the establishment of a monopoly price theory. 2. Natural monopoly. A favorite target of the critics of monopoly is the so-called natural monopoly, or public utility, where competition is naturally not feasible. A typically cited case is the water supply of a city. It is supposed to be technologically feasible for only one water company to exist for serving a city. No other firms are therefore able to compete, and special interference is alleged to be necessary to curb monopoly pricing by this utility. In the first place, such a limited space monopoly is just one case in which only one firm in a field is profitable. How many firms will be profitable in any line of production is an institutional question and depends on such concrete data as the degree of consumer demand, the type of product sold, the physical productivity of the processes, the supply and pricing of factors, the forecasting of entrepreneurs, etc. spatial limitations may be unimportant, as in the case of the grocers. The spatial limits may allow only the narrowest of monopolies, the monopoly over the portion of sidewalk owned by the seller. On the other hand, conditions may be such that only one firm may be feasible in the industry. But we have seen that this is irrelevant. Monopoly is a meaningless appellation unless monopoly price is achieved. And once again, there is no way of determining whether the price charged for the good is a monopoly price or not. And this applies to all circumstances, including a nationwide telephone firm, a local water company, or an outstanding baseball player. All these persons or firms will be monopolies within their industry, and in all these cases, the dichotomy between monopoly price and competitive price is still an illusory one. Furthermore, there are no rational grounds by which we can preserve a separate sphere for public utilities and subject them to special harassment. A public utility industry does not differ conceptually from any other, and there is no non-arbitrary method by which we can designate certain industries to be clothed in the public interest while others are not. In no case, therefore, on the free market can a monopoly price be conceptually distinguished from a competitive price. All prices on the free market are competitive. As Mises writes, prices are a market phenomenon. They are the resultant of a certain constellation of market data, of actions and reactions of the members of a market society. It is vain to meditate what prices would have been if some of their determinants had been different. It is no less vain to ponder on what prices ought to be. Everybody is pleased if the prices of things he wants to buy drop and the prices of the things he wants to sell rise. Any price determined on a market is the necessary outgrowth of the interplay of the forces operating, that is, demand and supply. Whatever the market situation which generated this price may be, with regard to it, the price is always adequate, genuine, and real. It cannot be higher if no bidder ready to offer a higher price turns up, and it cannot be lower if no seller ready to deliver at a lower price turns up. Only the appearance of such people ready to buy or sell can alter prices. Economics does not develop formulas which would enable anybody to compute a correct price different from that established on the market by the interaction of buyers and sellers. This refers also to monopoly prices. No alleged fact-finding and no armchair speculation can discover another price at which demand and supply would become equal. The failure of all experiments to find a satisfactory solution for the limited space monopoly of public utilities clearly proves this truth.